Welcome to Planetary Conversations. I'm your host, Warren Bell. Each week I talk with experienced and knowledgeable guests from all backgrounds and walks of life as we explore ideas and actions that can restore the health of our planet and heal our relations with one another. Check out our website at voiceoftheshoeshop.ca, and you can find all our episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Shukapmakulu, the stolen, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Suquepic people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. How do you make life better for people who face true existential challenges, living in grinding poverty and experiencing disease and premature death, when you are associated with a political system that created many of the rules that caused those difficulties for them in the first place? Wealthy Eurocentric nations have a long history of violent colonialism on every continent and through five centuries. They have left colonized societies in tatters, their governance systems reduced to puppetry, their sources of prosperity stolen or reduced to remnants, and their social order chaotic. To truly make amends for this history, one has to approach those in difficulty and distress in a spirit of true humility. You ask them to tell you their stories, you listen carefully, and for as long as it takes for that story to be told. You meet them where they are, not where you think they should be, and you ask them to tell you how you can help, and then you do something. We now recognize that those who were the former agents of such harms must play an active part in the process of healing, underpinned by a growing acknowledgement that equitable sharing of the planet's gifts and resources is mandatory, and that all persons deserve respect, dignity, and meaningful security of person and of community. My guest today is someone who spent many years embodying the need to redress and rebalance relationships around the world. Alicia Eliamin is a human rights lawyer, the director of the Global Health and Rights Project at Harvard Law School, and with a cross appointment at Harvard's Chan School of Public Health. For three decades, Alicia has immersed herself in strengthening human rights and their role in fostering human and planetary health, especially, to quote the title of one of her books, When Misfortune Becomes Injustice. Alicia, it's wonderful to have you join us today on Planetary Conversations.
Thank you so much, Warren. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, I was making notes for today and I was musing about your name and the fact that it doesn't contain any consonants, you know, sort of hard consonants like K and T and D and hard G. And it made me think of what we talked about before we came on air. And a few days ago, and that was about the role and the impact of a woman going to situations where, you know, often there's a patriarchal social order in play and, you know, women are not necessarily given the attention and respect that one would expect in, say, more balanced societies. And I wonder, just to start off, if you would muse for a moment on that situation, being a woman going into sometimes very challenging, fraught situations, socially speaking, and how that played out.
So I think patriarchy is really a complex system that interacts with racial and ethnic discrimination and other kinds of patterns. So, and I have, as you said in your generous introduction, I've worked in Latin America, in Africa, in the United States. So I think I've experienced it differently, sometimes as hostility, sometimes as dismissal, sometimes as actual sort of assaults. But I would say that it's not just what happens out there to others. It's also here in the United States, where I'm sitting right now, we have movements to reestablish biblical patriarchy. We have an administration that is the most pronatalist and anti-gender equality that has existed in my lifetime. So
the role of women is not occupying a more prominent place around the world. I think that evidence is pretty clear from both studies and from people's observations. The organization I helped to found 30 years ago had a male executive director, a male part-time assistant, and one female assistant. Now it's got 14 or 15 staff members. They're all women except for one guy, who, and all he's allowed to do is take notes. So it's an interesting change. Now, again, preparing for this visit, I remember a study I heard about 40 or 50 years ago done by PAHO, the Pan-American Health Organization, in which they gave $100 to a number of women and they gave $100 to a number of men in Central and South American countries, and they let them have the money and then saw what they did with it. And overall, the women tended to use money to pay for food for their children, for housing needs and clothing. And the men, by and large, not all of them, but much more so than the women, spend it on things like alcohol and gambling and, to some degree, womanizing. Now, that's 40 or 50 years ago, and it's a pretty bleak picture and very dichotomous picture as well. You've had three plus decades of occupation and work and commitment to social change in many different ways. I wonder if over time you see shifting patterns in that male-female responsibility, commitment, orientation.
Well, so first, I think that's really interesting data that you point to, and obviously they're generalizations, but I actually did a multi-year, multi-country study on what happens when mothers die in childbirth, what happens to the kids, and really losing your mother, and it was in sub-Saharan Africa, it was in East Africa and Southern Africa. Losing a mother if you're poor in a poor country is just about the worst possible thing that can happen to you. Worse than having HIV/AIDS. So the mortality rates just absolutely skyrocket. And even in a wealthier country like South Africa, where there's some social protection schemes, the mothers play a huge role in, as you said, paying for school fees, mediating sexual mores. When I did the study, it was a big reason to show the cost of inaction on maternal health around the world. So I think that, you know, that was not that long ago. That was maybe 10 years ago. Certainly, we see it's a stereotype and a generalization, but sometimes stereotypes have some truth in them. And what is unfortunate, I think, is connecting that division of labor within households to the larger trends in the political economy. Because when the state retracts social services and provisions, that puts more obligations on women in the household. And the dichotomies between men and women become even sharper.
I can imagine that. And I can imagine, going back to some of the things I was saying in the introduction, that the only way to really understand what's happening is to get into the middle of it. The way you actually intervene, and you made a point when we were talking before about not being an academic alone. There's a big academic component to what you do. But a person ends up being an activist because you yourself have kind of, you use the phrase, getting into the trenches. And it seems to me that that is a key element in what you've done over the years. It's not staying in the ivory tower. I mean, good Lord, you have a spot in the most ivory of all ivory towers in the world, Harvard University. But you've made a point of immersing yourself in the actual scenes and scenarios that you've explored and talk about in terms of human rights. And that's been an important thing, right?
That has been sort of the defining quality of my life. I mean, I think I mentioned before, I would have absolutely withered if I'd stayed in the ivory tower. To be able to understand reality and the obstacles people face to living free and flourishing lives, you have to actually accompany them where they live. Many people, when they introduce me, describe me as a scholar activist, which is a label that I quite appreciate because, you know, I do take advantage of being able to step back and think about larger trends. But my work is always informed. Bell Hooks said theory is a laboratory for practice. And I really adopt that perspective. I think that the greatest experts about how to advance their own human rights and well-being are the people who are living through those experiences. Yes. And you know, people from far away don't need to come in and tell them in a missionary style way what they should be doing differently.
I'm glad you said that because I don't feel too vulnerable about my introduction saying that, you know, when you're an agent of a system, you're associated with a system that has brought about some of the negative changes, you can't deal with remedies from a hands-off position. You have to be right in the middle of it. Now, another thing you've made a point of pointing out to me before was that throughout your career, you've looked at things holistically. And in fact, what you said was to change the world, you have to know what it is. You have to know how the whole system works. Over the years, do you feel you've got a progressive grip on that sort of whole system understanding?
Honestly, I will confess, Warren, that, you know, in reflecting back on experiences that I've had, I have imbued them with different kinds of meaning. There's a line from a T.S. Eliot poem, we had the experience but missed the meaning. Return to the meaning restores the experience, but in a different form where it's more universal. And that has really been the story of much of my life. I mean, I think now, obviously, when so many things have been shattered and fallen apart, it is incumbent on the people who've been in the trenches and working toward human rights and health to reflect on, you know, maybe how we could have done things differently, what happened. I am much more focused now. I think I'm more radical now than I was when I was young. I'm much more focused on the overall political economy, this sort of extractivist world order, as you set up very nicely in the introduction. And I've grown more skeptical of what, for example, courts can achieve in advancing social justice meaningfully.
I think that's a wonderful point because it's, I think, increasingly widely understood that working on an issue has to be done at multiple levels simultaneously. And in fact, sometimes you start off at one and you end up at quite a different one sort of overall. I wonder if you could also comment a little bit about, because part of your orientation is around planetary health as well as human health and human rights. And I think Herman Daly said that the human economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the ecological economy or the economy of the environment. How does that play out in the work you're doing? And that, I suspect, has changed over the years as well, as humanity has become far more attuned to our impact on the ecosystem because it's pretty hard to ignore these days. How do you see that evolving in the work you've done, that planetary influence?
I think it definitely has evolved. We just were not as conscious about all of the effects that human activity is having, I mean, on climate as well as just environmental issues, right? We weren't as aware of plastics, for example. I think again, it's because I'm much more attuned to those connections now. So the kind of looking at issues of the so-called green transition that actually depends on a lot of extractivism in the global south and drawing those connections. I have learned a lot over the years from working in indigenous communities in Latin America. And I will say that a while ago when I would teach, you know, indigenous approaches to health or understandings of health events in the United States at Harvard, it would be taken as sort of a sort of folklore type approach. And some people thought I was frankly kind of crazy. But now there's a lot more openness to understanding and learning from indigenous approaches, especially ecofeminism.
I recently interviewed Nicole Redvers, who is involved with the Planetary Health Alliance, and we talked mostly about her origin story because it's quite compelling. And that dichotomy between people who live close to the land and have deep cultural experience of doing so is so profoundly, well, I should say, we've separated ourselves from our past where we were like that. And it's leaving this huge gap in human conduct brought about by the sort of elite communities, civilizations, as it were, that are now realizing that they've stuck their foot in a bed of hot coals and it's not going to get any better unless they do something about it.
I actually met Nicole through a Lancet Commission on Arctic and Northern Health that focuses on Indigenous. She's amazing. So I'm delighted that you interviewed her. I will add one thing on planetary health. That is quite different from a sort of technocratic approach to developing indicators at the WHO and, you know, and figuring out what is the level of carbon dioxide that is compatible with. So there are real differences between an indigenous sort of epistemology and the kind of technocratic top-down thing that we often do in global health.
Oh my goodness, you really touched on a sensitive subject, because the clear-eyed empiricism that's associated with indigenous worldviews. Like, if you do this to this plant or that animal, this will be the result. If you don't do it, then this will be the result. So if you want things to go well, and there's a strong indigenous community near the town I live in, Salmon Arm, and learning from them how they see the world, as opposed to the sort of rarefied view from afar that is entertained by many people of in sort of a Eurocentric background, it's really quite astonishing to see that you look at the same landscape and you see different, almost different planets. It's like you're on a different kind of space. Now, you have some bona fides when it comes to internationalism, because you've been entertained by two continents primarily, North and South America. Although you're born in New York City, you went to Argentina, your mother's home country, and then you left there to come back because of what was a pretty horrendous dictatorship with disappearances all over the place. What was it like growing up in a genuine Hispanic world, if you like? I mean, it's a colony, but it's pretty Hispanic as a colony. What was it like for you growing up there as opposed to the U.S.?
Well, I was young when we moved to the U.S. And I should say that my mother is British Argentine. Mm-hmm. The British played a very large role in Argentina, building railroads, etc. So I think growing up with that background, one, the civic military dictatorship, as you noted, loomed very large in my upbringing. Mm-hmm. But as I got older, I sort of had this kind of double screen feeling of like, what would my life have been like had I continued to live in Argentina? Mm-hmm. What access to higher education, to becoming the person I am, would have been possible? Mm-hmm. And that's something that I continually, I mean, I did my doctorate at the Universidad de Buenos Aires. I go frequently. I have an affiliation with another law school in Argentina. So I do reflect on that quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, during the pandemic that came up, because I had relatives who obviously didn't get access to vaccines at the same time we in the United States got access to vaccines. And lots of other issues. So I do constantly wrestle with that.
Well, it certainly means that you would take pronouncements in either social ecosystem with a grain of salt, because you know that there's another way that things can be. It's quite different. It's not totally different. It's not as different as, say, growing up in a small indigenous community yourself. But it does. I think that's why when you're young, you travel. You had a grandfather who was, you said, the word you used was worship.
I did. You know, because we moved to the United States and there was much less family around. So my grandparents had a huge role in my upbringing, in taking care of us when my parents were not around. And I actually think that is a sad thing that many people who were kind of middle class and upper middle class no longer have. But in my case, I spent a lot of time with our paternal grandparents. And my grandfather was a house painter, a longtime union activist, an autodidact. He went to Cooper Union, which is a school in New York City, at night, which was free at the time, financed but through philanthropy, because he dropped out of primary school. And I just remember as a child, whether sometimes he would take us in New York, he would take me and my brother to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which also was free at the time. And he would both paint and do replicas of the drawings, and also walk around with us and talk to us. And it was just an absolute privilege. But then there were other times where they lived in a rent-controlled apartment in Brooklyn with sometimes the heat wasn't working tremendously well. And we'd sit with the oven open and he'd just tell me stories. And he was just an incredible, generous, brave man. He was back in the day in World War One, his brother was drafted, and his brother had a family. So my grandfather took his place as a private in the trenches of World War One. I mean, he's just, I worshipped him. I adored him.
My goodness. You've just given one of the best accolades for grandparents, grandfathers and grandmothers. It seems to me, you said that continuity between generations has been lost for a lot of people these days, partly because people move all over the place. They don't stay in one place long enough. But in countries where people stay in one place, the contact between generations is much more expansive, and it's much more powerful. And there's something that leavens the enthusiasm of younger generations when they have access to the wise second thought of an older generation. Did that have an influence on you in terms of, you know, where you wanted to go and work? I mean, you sat with your grandfather with an open oven, keeping the room warm. Do you see any connection between that, I mean, his activism? I think you called the politics of the street, when we were talking earlier, which I think is a wonderful way to describe it. Do you see that kind of shaping how you move forward when you got out of high school and went into formal education and that kind of thing?
Oh, absolutely. And actually, on both sides, because the dictatorship in Argentina is often portrayed as, just a tax on political dissidents, but it was really protecting an entrenched class structure and privilege, as well as the traditional Christian family structure. So there were massive, massive assaults on labor organizers and labor unions. And that the sort of social justice angle, which I think I got from both sides, has really kind of driven all of the work that I've done. I frequently talk to my classes. I mean, labor has been decimated in the United States. 7% of private corporations are unionized. I mean, it's horrible.
I mean, these are trends that have taken place in the world that we call developed. And yet it's a sign of a sort of a retreat from reality and a retreat from basic human rights that we probably all think are important, unless we're not having to deal with those kinds of situations ourselves, and then we sometimes bypass them. Now, your first taste of higher education, so-called, was Harvard College. Were you starting to get into the stuff that really mattered to you, or was that more of a general kind of...
No, I was always, I remember in high school doing some things that were probably not prudent, breaking into a coal factory to do a school project on the need for solar power, and lots of protests about, at the time it was South Africa and apartheid, and so going to college at that time, there was still a lot more to protest about South Africa, but also U.S. out of Central America, really. And, public high school in the United States was not exactly something that really fostered critical inquiry. So when I got to college, it was just... it's just extraordinary, to be able to take the kinds of courses I wanted, to be able to hear people say things that I had never heard before, to kind of connect the dots between U.S., as you said in the introduction, U.S. history and foreign policy, and the dictatorships in the Southern Cone. And, I remember taking a seminar on labor movements, like all of that kind of simmered and bubbled up in my head.
I can see you being led astray into the direction you were really going. That's how it often works in life. You hear something and you immediately recognize it because you have something in you already that is latent, waiting to speak. Then you went to law school. That was the next step. And after that, you went to Mexico for some extension of training and one thing and another. Everything that we talked about suggests to me that that was a seminal experience for you in terms of putting you up, face to face with some of the things that have motivated you ever since then, really. Seeing what was actually going on in mental health treatment of women, that kind of thing. Why don't you lay out a little bit of that process, that learning process?
Sure. So that's right. I spent a year in Argentina between college and law school. But after law school, I had a fellowship. And it was really to do pretty traditional human rights work. At the time, there was this idea that supranational forums, like what we call the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, the European Court of Human Rights, different treaty monitoring bodies are also, you can bring cases to them. So when local courts weren't redressing human rights, you could do this at an international level. And that was really just kind of starting at the time because it had to wait until after the Cold War thawed. So my fellowship was really with the idea of sort of bringing some of these very hard and structural cases to international forums. And those were pretty brutal, you know, issues of arbitrary detentions and extrajudicial executions and mass torture, etc. But while I was living in Mexico, I had already, decided that I wanted to use human rights to advance social justice. And while I was living in Mexico, I had the opportunity to spend a lot of time in indigenous communities. I had the opportunity to work with people who were investigating the mental health system. And it was in those encounters, and I would say particularly in rural communities, where I began to see fully how much health reflected patterns of social inequality, injustice, in all kinds of ways. I mean, gendered injustice, exclusion of indigenous communities, horrific abuses of patients in mental institutions. So absolutely, and also the law wasn't really developed. I mean, we were still treating human rights as basically sort of civil rights and torture and due process, and these poverty and structural issues were in the background. So it was formative.
And I'm interested to know, you said you had the opportunity. Were these situations where somebody said, we're going to take you off somewhere, or you can, you know, we're going up to some place in, you know, in the rainforest up on a mountain somewhere? Or were there things where you kind of said, I want to find out more, and you sort of wangled your way into traveling out of the sort of populated centers?
No, I think it was usually, I mean, it was at a time when the, some of it was, for example, when Eric Rosenthal of Mental Disability Rights came down to Mexico, and it was before Mental Disability Rights International existed, but he later came down and we worked together. So that was being invited. But it was also at a time in the early 90s when, it was before the North American Free Trade Agreement. It was before the Zapatista revolt that happened among indigenous communities, in large measure because of the terrible inequalities in health. And so being part of a local human rights group meant that I was sent places or asked to do things, but it wasn't me saying, oh, I'd like to see this reality, you know. Mm-hmm.
It seems like it would, if something came up that involved going off to an out-of-the-way place where things could be happening that would involve injustice and involve imbalance and inequity, you might have just found yourself, I mean, You and Eric Rosenthal got together because you probably shared a whole bunch of similar beliefs and ethical concerns.
So
that way.
Eric actually came down initially when he was working at Minnesota Advocates for Human Rights to investigate terrible military abuses in an indigenous community in the north of Mexico. That's really when we got to know each other, and I'm not sure what effect that experience had on him, but I've written about it. It's very clear that that really was a turning point for me, actually, that trip. And I think I described to you seeing a baby die of diarrheal dehydration on that trip. And the mother not recognizing that as a human rights abuse for which the government was responsible through its neglect, just as she did realize that the kinds of, you know, burning crops and displacement were human rights abuses committed by the military. But Eric and I then had a very, very long pickup truck ride back to a place where we could take a plane. And that's when we sort of started brainstorming about Mental Disability Rights International.
You know, it's a term that has been used on this program before is serendipity. And serendipity is a wonderful thing. It's a guiding, I think it's a guiding force in the universe. It's up there with quantum physics and interstellar sort of magnetism. But the one thing that I thought would also have been a really important factor was the fact that you could speak Spanish and you could speak it presumably
fluently.
Yes, like a native. Did you have an Argentinian accent, I must ask?
Yes, very yes. much
and
so.
And do people say, oh, you must be from Argentina?
Yes, very all the time. Well, which is not always an advantage. I mean, you know, that's very, very different from a Mexican accent.
Yes.
Very
different. Yes, indeed. Well, it's like French in Canada versus French in France. There are two different distinct universes. Why don't you talk a little bit about the treatment of people with mental health and disabilities of one sort or another? I've seen on the Disability International website some pretty heart-rending stories and pictures of people, young people often, just in relationship with the society around them and even their own families that are pretty abysmal. What sort of things did you see and how did that impact you?
I think, as you know, I've talked about this before. I think the way we treat people with psychosocial disabilities mm-hmm. is in many societies worse than the way we treat hardened criminals. The kind of social revulsion that serious mental health issues elicits, the need to control people. You know, I found some of the work. I went on to do field investigations with Mental Disability Rights International, which, by the way, is now Disability Rights International. Yes. And, you know, some of those experiences of seeing people, babies shackled or children basically shackled or held in very small places where they couldn't. I mean, it was sort of like veal, you know, it was just horrific. The most basic kinds of decisions taken away from them, often women either completely desexualized or hypersexualized, but things that, you know, are so taken for granted about the freedom of movement, freedom of association, as well as obviously the right to health and adequate health care, which is rarely the case, including in the country I'm sitting in now. Mm. I think we have a horrific mental health system. So it was frankly some of the hardest kinds of investigations to do,
indeed,
seeing
indeed.
Children.
Yes, you're face to face with humans treating other humans in ways that are, as you say, incomprehensible. If you think what you or I would want to have done to us if we were in a similar situation, it would be devastating. With respect to women's health, you also saw really some very tragic things. I think it's reasonable to mention that your first pregnancy ended with a miscarriage, but you did that happen to you in the middle of a very supportive healthcare system, or at least a very well-serviced healthcare system. And yet you saw women, and one in particular you mentioned to me that it's stayed with me, was of a woman who was having a miscarriage and well, why don't you tell the story of that one? Because it was a group of elders who played an important role in a negative
way. Yeah, I mean, that was in Mexico, long after I had moved back to the United States, not a few years after I'd moved back to the United States. And as you said, I had a miscarriage before I had my kids. I was a very wanted child, so it was emotionally devastating. But physically, it was not a big deal, right? It was an outpatient surgery. It was, and I had been invited previously to do a fact-finding investigation with Physicians for Human Rights in the southern Mexican state of Chiapas. But by this time, the Zapatista rebellion had happened, and there was a lot of displacement of the Zapatista communities. There was a lot of paramilitary violence, religious strife. So I picked myself up emotionally, went on that investigation, and in one of those internally displaced camps, we came across a woman who was hemorrhaging and miscarrying at just about precisely the same stage of pregnancy that I had been literally the week before. And when that happens to you, it's sort of,
it's visceral.
There, but for the grace of God, go I, yeah. Right? It's, you drop the, or at least I immediately dropped the neutral, I'm a human rights observer and I'm documenting impacts of government policy, and I organized, you know, she was in that position because, as you pointed out, the elders in the community had decided that it would be better for her to die with dignity than to seek care at the nearest hospital, because the Mexican government at the time was using the healthcare system as a weapon of counterinsurgency. And interrogating anybody who could possibly be associated with the Zapatistas was interrogated for information, etc. So I immediately organized a colleague who was with us to take her to the hospital, to stay with her, to accompany her through the whole process, ensure that she was not asked any questions, and then to bring her back to the community. But I mean, when something like that happens to you, you start to think, obviously, you know, about your own suffering, about the suffering of other people who are in very, very different situations. And it's sort of something that haunts me. That's why I called the title of my book, When Misfortune Becomes Injustice. How do you separate what is misfortune and suffering and real injustice? And that's essentially what I've been doing for the rest of my career. I've spent interviewing women who had near misses in pregnancy, family members and husbands who are widowers and survived, or mothers of women who died, and trying to figure out why this happened. And when in many parts of the world, when a woman dies in childbirth, they're not told why it happened, right? They're just said, oh, she died. So just even doing the process of investigating and bringing that fact back to the loved ones provides some degree of closure, and that this was not bad luck on their parts, but it was an injustice.
You know, a moment ago you said you lost the capacity to be a disinterested observer and analyzer of data and became an engaged human being. And to me, it seems it's a peculiar situation to find oneself in, to actually have to say, I lost that neutral status. How can one be neutral when one is embodied and one watches someone who is also embodied going through a terrible situation? But it's indicative of kind of the way we've got trapped into this sort of intellectualism about what's going on in the world around us, that we would, and I'm sure as a physician myself, you know, you're supposed to be neutral. You're never neutral. You can never be neutral. You know, you have to be engaged by having a sense, maybe it's embodied or maybe it's just psychological, that you're actually, you know, connected to the person who is suffering, and that therefore you know what, in a way, you know what to do, because you, if you have, you know, some skills, of course, or you're a lawyer, you can act on somebody's behalf. If I'm a physician, I can engage in some intervention. I want to say for everyone who, like you, was caught in that dilemma, I think it's time we abandoned the notion of neutrality and surrendered to the notion of engagement. Can you do that?
Oh, I totally agree. I do think, Warren, that both for physicians and lawyers, you run up against the problem of not being able to do enough constantly, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I mean, many of the problems that you've probably seen and many of the problems that I've seen are really driven by, you know, our structures of poverty, yes. and exclusion, and the tools that we have are radically inadequate.
And I think that's why the title of your book is so important. It's speaking to the fact that you create a bad system, you get bad outcomes. And I think that's well recognized in systems theory, that you cannot really rely on a bad system to generate good outcomes. It's probably not going to do that. So you have to get better system. It's systems thinking is an important part of any kind of rehabilitative process. So maybe you could just walk quickly through some of the other places in the world that you have visited and lived in, because there have been a number. Peru, you were involved with a program on human rights and health, and in fact, you co-founded a group that worked on those kinds of... Just briefly, what were you engaged in there, and what was the structure that you're working with?
So I was living in Peru to set up a maternal health program, and I was at the time on the faculty of Columbia University School of Public Health, the Mailman School now. But I was approached by a Peruvian colleague who has since obviously become a very dear friend, because, you know, it was way back when there were all possibilities, but not a lot of things had been done, right? Everything was left to do. And so creating a program on human rights in health was completely new at the time. There were very, very few ideas of doing that. Even Physicians for Human Rights, where I worked later, was focusing on doctors, you know, forensically documenting torture or deaths through. So the idea that you would really take seriously that health in a country and health systems were issues that you could create an advocacy community around was totally new. And Peru at the time, this was during the Fujimori regime, where close to 300,000 women, overwhelmingly indigenous, were forcibly sterilized, where the government was hiding, multi-drug resistant tuberculosis resistance and falsifying records. I mean, there were a lot of things to work on in Peru at the time. And just as in Mexico, where I worked with local groups, working in a local group and letting that, like, I didn't set the agenda. I didn't say, oh, this is how we should go about this, right? Mario Rios, who was the co-founder, really had a very strong idea of we needed to go work across the country, build networks, build political power, create a citizen forum on health. And obviously we interacted, and I was much more active on the sterilizations of the indigenous women because I'd already worked on reproductive health. But yeah, I think if Mexico was formative, Peru absolutely was consolidated my understanding of health systems as sometimes being colonialistic tools of suppression, as reflecting, you know, deeply ingrained inequities in society. And the need not to treat that as a background thing,
yes. Yeah.
but to really address it straight on.
Yes. And as you say, so many things that there are to do and you, how can you keep up with them? Just touch briefly on another international experience you had through the François-Xavier Banu Center, which is abbreviated as FXB, which was started, interestingly, and this is what caught my attention, by a very much a French aristocratic woman whose son was killed in a helicopter accident. That was the François-Xavier. And Albina de Bois-Rouvray, she set it up. But despite being an aristocrat, the goals for the Center for Health and Human Rights, as it was called, were to things like promote equity and dignity for those oppressed by racism, poverty, and stigma around the world and in the country. And then I was struck by the fact, it's explicit saying, the only university-wide center in the United States dedicated to the health and human rights of Palestinian and Roma people. You know, if there is a forgotten segment of humanity, it's what were derisively called gypsies. But the Roma people, the Palestinians, thank heavens, are getting some attention because of the horrible things that are happening in both the West Bank and Gaza. But Roma people are kind of left high and dry often. And the fact that it's one of the few places that actually addresses them. I mean, it's an interesting way we kind of marginalize people and then kind of forget about them and then remember them and bring them back into the fold, as it were. What was it like working there? I mean, just overall. It was also, one other thing, is addressing U.S. structural inequity. Good heavens, that sounds like, that sounds pinko, you know? We're getting into, you know, socialist things and all that kind of stuff.
So this is a little bit of a sad story because the Albina, the countess, mm-hmm. set up the FXB Center a long time ago, and mm-hmm. it's had a variety of different directors. The latest director, Mary Bassett, did focus on both Palestinian health and Roma health. The Roma component is really led by a Roma woman, Magda Matace, who's absolutely wonderful. And I had a chance to work with her even when I was there, because I'm no longer with the FXB Center. The Palestinian part is the sad part, in that Mary Bassett very bravely did create this focus. But Harvard has been the target of significant inquiry and investigation by the Trump administration.
That's very politely put.
And in particular around anti-Semitism questions, this concocted idea of anti-Semitism. And probably as a result of the focus on Palestinian health, you know, I can't prove that, but it's pretty clear that this was a very large factor. Mary Bassett was removed as director of the FXB yeah. centers quite summarily, and which created enormous outrage along with hundreds of other people. I wrote a letter and organized signatures on her behalf, and she's a titan of public health. So that's why I say it's a little bit of a sad story. We're not really sure what the FXB Center is going to focus on now.
Harvard has become the current administration's favorite target in the world of thought. There's too much thought going on at Harvard for the pleasure of the current administration, and it is a sad tale. I'm really sorry, but we've come close to the end of the hour. It's flown by, and I have more
it
pages.
It really has.
I have more pages of questions and comments and interactions that I was hoping to deal with. But I thought I could just read a final. This is a quote from the description of When Misfortune Becomes Injustice, the book that you wrote yourself. And it says this: the current institutionalized world order based on neoliberal financialized capitalism is incompatible with one in which the rights of diverse people around the globe can be realized. Now, that seems to be vintage Eliyamin. Can we sum up our conversation with that as a final comment? Is that okay?
That is perfect. Absolutely perfect. Because that is really, that is where all of my work is now. And I think it is the root source of so much environmental injustice, so much racial injustice, so much patriarchy. Absolutely.
And I'm going to ask, remind listeners or tell listeners that you're currently working on a document for the Defend Public Health. It's called the People's Health Platform, which is hopefully a small but significant pushback against the nonsense that's going on in political terms in the United States.
I would absolutely encourage people to go to defendpublichealth.org. We are building people power in this country, organizing and getting candidates to commit to these points on the platform, including taxing billionaires' wealth, which is, again, a political economy issue that directly affects the health systems and health outcomes that we can have in this country.
Alicia, we could be talking for a lot longer. Thank you so much for being with us. Hopefully sometime in the future we can have you back on the program and we can talk about some of these other issues, because they are germane to the survival of our species in comfort and thriving, and to our planetary home, keeping it hospitable for future generations. Thank you very much for being with us today.
I would love to come back. Thank you so much, Warren.